content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today, I will begin a series of readings of the works of J.D. Salinger, published in the New Yorker magazine. Despite his slim body of work and reclusive lifestyle, Salinger was one of the most influential American writers of the 20th century. His 1951 novel, The Catcher in the Rye, won critical acclaim and many devoted admirers, especially among the post-World War II generation. In 1953, Salinger moved from New York City to Cornish, New Hampshire, where he led a secluded life until his death at the age of 91 in 2010. From 1946 to 1965, however, Salinger published 13 short stories in the New Yorker magazine. Many of these stories inspired the early careers of writers such as Philip Roth, John Updike, and Harold Brodkey. Today, I will read the first short story Salinger published in the New Yorker magazine in 1946, The Slight Rebellion Off Madison, which later became the basis for The Catcher in the Rye, followed by A Perfect Day for Banana Fish, published in the January 31, 1948 issue of the New Yorker magazine. So, with no further ado, Slight Rebellion Off Madison by J.D. Salinger, published in the December 21, 1946 edition of the New Yorker magazine. On vacation from Pinsey Preparatory School for Boys, an instructor for every 10 students, Holden Morrissey Caulfield usually wore his Chesterfield and a hat with a cutting edge at the V in the crown. While riding in the Fifth Avenue buses, girls who knew Holden often thought they saw him walking past Saks or Altman's or Lord & Taylor's, but it was usually somebody else. This year, Holden's Christmas vacation from Pinsey Prep broke at the same time as Sally Hayes's from the Mary A. Woodruff School for Girls. Special attention to those interested in dramatics. On vacation from Mary A. Woodruff, Sally usually went hatless and wore her new silver-blue muskrat coat. While riding in Fifth Avenue buses, boys who knew Sally often thought they saw her walking past Saks or Altman's or Lord & Taylor's. It was usually somebody else. As soon as Holden got into New York, he took a cab home, dropped his Gladstone in the foyer, kissed his mother, lumped his hat and coat into a convenient chair, and dialed Sally's number. "Hey," he said into the mouthpiece, "Sally?" "Yes, who's that?" "Holden Caulfield. How are you?" "Holden, I'm fine. How are you?" "Swell," said Holden. "Listen, how are you anyway? I mean, how's school?" "Fine," said Sally. "I mean, you know." "Swell," said Holden. "Well, listen, what are you doing tonight?" Holden took her to the Wedgwood room that night, and they both dressed, Sally wearing her new turquoise job, and they danced a lot. Holden's style was long, slow, sidestepped back and forth, as though he were dancing over an open manhole. They danced cheek to cheek, and when their faces got sticky from contact, neither of them minded. It was a long time between vacations. They made a wonderful thing out of the taxi ride home. Twice, when the cab stopped short in traffic, Holden fell off the seat. "I love you," he swore to Sally, removing his mouth from hers. "Oh, darling, I love you too," Sally said, and added less passionately, "Promise me you'll let your hair grow out. Crew cuts are corny." The next day was a Thursday, and Holden took Sally to the matinee of Oh, Mistress Mine, which neither of them had seen. During the first intermission, they smoked in the lobby and vehemently agreed with each other that the lunts were marvelous. George Harrison of Andover also was smoking in the lobby, and he recognized Sally, as she hoped he would. They had been introduced once at a party and had never seen each other since. Now, in the lobby of the Empire, they greeted each other with the gusto of two who might frequently have taken baths together as small children. Sally asked George if he didn't think the show was marvelous. George gave himself a little room for his reply, bearing down on the foot of the woman behind him. He said that the play itself certainly was no masterpiece, but that the Lunts, of course, were absolute angels. Angels, Holden thought. Angels, for Christ's sake. Angels? After the matinee, Sally told Holden that she had a marvelous idea. Let's go ice skating at Radio City tonight. All right, Holden said. Sure. Do you mean it? Sally said. Don't just say it unless you mean it. I mean, I don't give a darn one way or the other. No, said Holden. Let's go. It might be fun. Sally and Holden were both terrible ice skaters. Sally's ankles had a painful, unbecoming way of collapsing toward each other, and Holden's weren't much better. That night, there were at least 100 people who had nothing better to do than watch the skaters. Let's get a table and have a drink, Holden suggested suddenly. Well, that's the most marvelous idea I've heard all day, Sally said. They removed their skates and sat down at a table in the warm inside lounge. Sally took off her red woolen mittens. Holden began to light matches. He let them burn down till he couldn't hold them. Then he dropped what was left into an ash. Look, Sally said, I have to know, are you or aren't you going to help me trim the tree Christmas Eve? Sure, said Holden without enthusiasm. I mean, I have to know, Sally said. Holden suddenly stopped lighting matches. He leaned forward over the table. Sally, did you ever get fed up? I mean, did you ever get scared that everything was going to go lousy unless you did something? Sure, said Sally. Do you like school? Holden inquired. Oh, it's a terrific bore. No, do you hate it, I mean? Well, I don't hate it. Well, I hate it, said Holden. Boy, do I hate it. But it isn't just that, it's everything. I hate living in New York. I hate Fifth Avenue buses and Madison Avenue buses and getting out at the center doors. I hate the 72nd Street movie with those fake clouds on the ceiling and being introduced to guys like George Harrison and going down in elevators when you want to go out and guys fitting your pants all the time at Brooks. His voice got more excited. Stuff like that. Know what I mean? You know something? You're the only reason I came home this vacation. Ah, you're sweet, said Sally, wishing he'd change the subject. Boy, I hate school. You ought to go to a boys' school sometime. All you do is study and make believe you give a damn if the football team wins. And talk about girls and clothes and liquor and... Now, listen, Sally interrupted. Lots of boys get more out of school than that. I agree, said Holden, but... That's all I get out of it. See? That's what I mean. I don't get anything out of anything. I'm in bad shape. I'm in lousy shape. Look, Sally, how would you like to just beat it? Here's my idea. I'll borrow Fred Halsley's car, and tomorrow morning we'll drive up to Massachusetts and Vermont and around there. See? It's beautiful. I mean, it's wonderful up there. Honest to God. We'll stay in these cabin camps and stuff like that till my money runs out. I have $112 with me. Then, when the money runs out, I'll get a job, and we'll live somewhere with a brook and stuff. Know what I mean? Honest to God, Sally, we'll have a swell time, and then later on we'll get married or something. What do you say? Come on, what do you say? Come on, let's do it, huh? You can't just... Do something like that, Sally said. Why not? Holden asked shrilly. Why the hell not? Because you can't, Sally said. You just can't, that's all. Supposing your money ran out and you didn't get a job, then what? Oh, I can get a job. Don't worry about that. You don't have to worry about that part of it. What's the matter? Don't you want to go with me? It isn't that, Sally said. It's not that at all. Holden, we'll have lots of time to do those things, all those things. After you go to college and we get married and all, there'll be oodles of marvelous places to go to. No, there wouldn't be, Holden said. It'd be entirely different. Sally looked at him. He had contradicted her so quietly. it wouldn't be the same at all. We'd have to go downstairs in elevators with suitcases and stuff. We'd have to call up everybody and tell them goodbye and send them postcards. And I'd have to work at my father's and ride in Madison Avenue buses and read newspapers. We'd have to go to the 72nd Street all the time and see newsreels. Newsreels! There's always a dumb horse race and some dame breaking a bottle over a ship. You don't see what I mean at all? Well, maybe I don't. Maybe you don't either, Sally said. Holden stood up, with his skates swung over one shoulder. You give me a royal pain, he announced quite dispassionately. A little after midnight, Holden and a fat, unattractive boy named Carl Luce sat at the Wadsworth Bar, drinking scotch and sodas and eating potato chips. Carl was at Pensy Prep, too, and led his class. Hey, Carl, Holden said, you're one of those intellectual guys. Tell me something. Supposing you were fed up. Supposing you were going stark, staring mad. Supposing you wanted to just quit school and everything and get the hell out of New York. What would you do? Drink up, Carl said. The hell with that. No, I'm serious, Holden pleaded. Oh, you've always got a bug, Carl said and got up and left. Holden went on drinking. He drank up $9 worth of scotch and sodas and at 2 a.m. made his way from the bar into the little anteroom where there was a telephone. He dialed three numbers before he got the proper one. Hello! Holden shouted into the phone. Who is this? Inquired a cold voice. This is me, Holden Caulfield. Can I speak to Sally, please? Sally's asleep. This is Mrs. Hayes. Why are you calling up at this hour, Holden?
Want to talk Sally, Miss Hayes? Very important. Put her on.
Sally's asleep, Holden. Call tomorrow. Good night.
Wake her up. Wake her up, huh? Wake her up, Miss Hayes.
Holden, Sally said from the other end of the wire. This is me. What's the idea?
Sally! Sally, that you?
Yes, and you're drunk.
Sally, I'll come over Christmas Eve. Trim the tree for you, huh? What do you say, huh?
Yes. Go to bed now. Where are you? Who's with you?
I'll trim the tree for you, huh? What do you say, huh?
Yes. Go to bed now. Where are you? Who's with you?
I'll trim the tree for you, huh? Okay?
Yes. Good night.
Good night. Good night, Sally baby. Sally sweetheart, darling.
Holden hung up and stood by the phone for nearly 15 minutes. Then he put another nickel in the slot and dialed the same number again.
Hello, he yelled into the mouthpiece. Speak to Sally, please.
There was a sharp click as the phone was hung up, and Holden hung up too. He stood swaying for a moment. Then he made his way into the men's room and filled one of the wash bowls with cold water. He immersed his head to the ears, after which he walked, dripping, to the radiator and sat down on it. He sat there counting the squares in the tile floor while the water dripped down his face and the back of his neck, soaking his shirt collar and necktie. 20 minutes later, the barroom piano player came in to comb his wavy hair.
Hiya, boy!
Holden greeted him from the radiator.
I'm on the hot seat. They pulled the switch on me. I'm getting fried.
The piano player smiled.
Boy, you can play, Holden said. You really can play that piano. You ought to go on the radio. You know that? You're damn good, boy.
You want a towel, fella? Asked the piano player.
Not me, said Holden.
Why don't you go home, kid? Holden shook his head.
Not me, he said. Not me.
The piano player shrugged and replaced the lady's comb in his inside pocket. When he left the room, Holden stood up from the radiator and blinked several times to let the tears out of his eyes. Then he went to the check room. He put on his Chesterfield without buttoning it and jammed his hat on the back of his soaking wet head.
his teeth chattering violently. Holden stood on the corner and waited for a Madison Avenue bus. It was a long wait. Next, I'll read the second short story published by Salinger in the New Yorker magazine, A Perfect Day for Banana Fish by J.D. Salinger, published in the January 31st, 1948 edition of the New Yorker magazine. There were 97 New York advertising men in the hotel, and the way they were monopolizing the long-distance lines, the girl in 507 had to wait from noon till almost 2:30 to get her call through. To use the time, though, she read an article in a women's pocket-size magazine called Sex is Fun or Hell. She washed her comb and brush. She took the spot out of the skirt of her beige suit. She moved the button on her Saks blouse. She tweezed out two freshly surfaced hairs in her mole. When the operator finally rang her room, she was sitting on the window seat and had almost finished putting lacquer on the nails of her left hand. She was a girl who, for a ringing phone, dropped exactly nothing. She looked as if her phone had been ringing continually ever since she had reached puberty. With her little lacquer brush, while the phone was ringing, she went over the nail of her little finger, accentuating the line of the moon. She then replaced the cap on the bottle of lacquer and, standing up, passed her left, the wet hand, back and forth through the air. With her dry hand, she picked up a congested ashtray from the window seat and carried it with her over to the night table, on which the phone stood. She sat down on one of the made-up twin beds and, it was the fifth or sixth ring, picked up the phone. "Hello?" she said, keeping the fingers of her left hand outstretched and away from her white silk dressing gown, which was all that she was wearing, except mules. Her rings were in the bathroom. "I have your call to New York now, Mrs. Glass," the operator said. "Thank you," said the girl, and made room on the night table for the ashtray. A woman's voice came through. "Muriel, is that you?" The girl turned the receiver slightly away from her ear. "Yes, Mother. How are you?" she said. "I've been worried to death about you. Why haven't you phoned? Are you all right?" "I tried to get you last night and the night before. The phone here's been..." "Are you all right, Muriel?" The girl increased the angle between the receiver and her ear. "I'm fine. I'm hot. This is the hottest day they've had in Florida in..." "Why haven't you called me? I've been worried." "Mother, darling, don't yell at me. I can hear you beautifully," said the girl. "I called you twice last night. Once just after. I told your father you'd probably call last night, but no, he had to..." "Are you all right, Muriel? Tell me the truth." "I'm fine. Stop asking me that, please." "When did you get there?" "I don't know. Wednesday morning, early." "Who drove?" "He did," said the girl. "And don't get excited. He drove very nicely. I was amazed." "He drove? Muriel, you gave me your word of..." "Mother," the girl interrupted, "I just told you. He drove very nicely. Under 50 the whole way, as a matter of fact." "Did he try any of that funny business with the trees?" "I said he drove very nicely, Mother. Now, please." "I asked him to stay close to the white line and all that, and he knew what I meant, and he did. He was even trying not to look at the trees. You could tell." "Did Daddy get the car fixed, incidentally?" "Not yet. They want $400 just to..." "Mother, Seymour told Daddy that he'd pay for it. There's no reason for..." Well, we'll see. How did he behave in the car and all?" "All right," said the girl. "Did he keep calling you that awful..." "No. He has something new now."
"What?"
"Oh, what's the difference, Mother?" "Muriel, I want to know. Your father..."
All right. "He calls me Miss Spiritual Tramp of 1948, the girl said and giggled.
It isn't funny, Muriel. It isn't funny at all. It's horrible. It's sad, actually. When I think how... Mother, the girl interrupted, listen to me. You remember that book you sent me from Germany? You know those German poems? What'd I do with it? I've been racking my... You have it. Are you sure? Said the girl. Certainly, that is. I have it. It's in Freddy's room. You left it here and I didn't have room for it in the... Why? Does he want it? No, only he asked me about it when we were driving down. He wanted to know if I'd read it. It was in German! Yes, dear, that doesn't make any difference, said the girl, crossing her legs. He said that the poems happened to be written by the only great poet of the century. He said I should have bought a translation or something, or learned the language, if you please. Awful, awful. It's sad, actually, is what it is. Your father said last night, just a second, Mother, the girl said. She went over to the window seat for her cigarettes, lit one, and returned to her seat on the bed. Mother, she said, exhaling smoke. Muriel, now listen to me. I'm listening. Your father talked to Dr. Savetsky. Oh, said the girl. He told him everything. At least, he said he did. You know your father. The trees. The business with the window, those horrible things he said to Granny about her plans for passing away, and what he did with all those lovely pictures from Bermuda. Everything. Well, said the girl. Well, in the first place, he said it was a perfect crime. The army released him from the hospital. My word of honor. He very definitely told your father there's a chance, a very great chance, he said, that Seymour may completely lose control of himself. My word of honor. There's a psychiatrist here at the hotel, said the girl. Who? What's his name? I don't know. Reiser or something. He's supposed to be very good. Never heard of him. Well, he's supposed to be very good anyway. Muriel, don't be fresh, please. We're very worried about you. Your father wanted to wire you last night to come home. As a matter of... I'm not coming home right now, Mother, so relax. Muriel, my word of honor, Dr. Savetsky said Seymour may completely lose control. I just got here, Mother. This is the first vacation I've had in years, and I'm not going to just pack everything and come home, said the girl. I couldn't travel now anyway. I'm so sunburned I can hardly move. You're badly sunburned? Didn't you use that jar of bronze I put in your bag? I put it right. I used it. I'm burned anyway. That's terrible. Where are you burned? All over, dear, all over. That's terrible. I'll live. Tell me, did you talk to the psychiatrist? Well, sort of, said the girl. What'd he say? Where was Seymour when you talked to him? In the ocean room, playing the piano. He's played the piano both nights we've been here. Well, what'd he say? Oh, nothing much. He spoke to me first. I was sitting next to him at bingo last night, and he asked me if that wasn't my husband playing the piano in the other room, and I said yes, it was. And he asked me if Seymour had been sick or something, so I said, why do you ask that? I don't know, Mother. I guess because he's so pale and all, said the girl. Anyway, after bingo, he and his wife asked me if I'd like to join them for a drink, so I did. His wife was horrible. You remember that awful dinner dress we saw in Bomwit's window? The one you said you'd have to have a tiny, tiny... The green? She had it on, and all hips. She kept asking me if Seymour's related to that Suzanne Glass that has that place on Madison Avenue, the millinery. What'd he say, though? The doctor! Oh, well, nothing much, really. I mean, we were in the bar and all, and it was terribly noisy. Yes, but did you tell him what he tried to do with Granny's chair? No, Mother. I didn't go into details very much, said the girl. I'll probably get a chance to talk to him again. He's in the bar all day long. Did he say he thought there was a chance he might get, you know, funny or anything? Do something to you?
Not exactly, said the girl. He had to have more facts, Mother. They have to know about your childhood, all that stuff. I told you, we could hardly talk. It was so noisy in there. Well, how's your blue coat? All right, I had some of the padding taken out. How are the clothes this year? Terrible. But out of this world, you see sequins everywhere, said the girl. How's your room? All right. Just all right, though. We couldn't get the room we had before the war, said the girl. The people are awful this year. You should see what sits next to us in the dining room. At the next table, they look as if they drove down in a truck. Well, it's that way all over now. How's your ballerina? It's too long. I told you it was too long. Muriel, I'm only going to ask you once more. Are you really all right? Yes, Mother, said the girl, for the 19th time. And you don't want to come home? No, Mother. Your father said last night that he'd be more than willing to pay for it if you'd go away someplace by yourself and think things over. You could take a lovely cruise. We both thought, no thanks, said the girl and uncrossed her legs. Mother, this call is costing up, for when I think of how you waited for that boy all through the war, I mean, when you think of all those crazy little wives who... Mother, said the girl, we'd better hang up. Seymour may come in any minute. Where is he? On the beach. On the beach? By himself? Does he behave himself on the beach? Mother, said the girl, you talk about him as though he were a raving maniac. I said nothing of the kind, Muriel. Well, you sound that way. I mean, all he does is lie there. He won't take his bathrobe off. He won't take his bathrobe off? Why not? I don't know. I guess because he's so pale. My goodness, he needs the sun. Can't you make him? You don't see more, said the girl and crossed her legs again. He says he doesn't want a lot of fools looking at his tattoo. He doesn't have any tattoo. Did he get one in the army? No, Mother. No, dear, said the girl and stood up. Listen, I'll call you tomorrow, maybe. Muriel, now listen to me. Yes, Mother, said the girl, putting her weight on her right leg. Call me the instant he does or says anything at all funny. You know what I mean. Do you hear me? Mother, I'm not afraid of Seymour. Muriel, I want you to promise me. All right, I promise. Goodbye, Mother, said the girl. My love to Daddy. And she hung up. Seymour Glass, said Sybil Carpenter, who was staying at the hotel with her mother. Did you see more glass? Pussycat, stop saying that. It's driving Mommy absolutely crazy. Hold still, please. Mrs. Carpenter was putting suntan oil on Sybil's shoulders, spreading it down over the delicate, wing-like blades of her back. Sybil was sitting insecurely on a huge inflated beach ball, facing the ocean. She was wearing a canary-yellow two-piece bathing suit, one piece of which she would not actually be needing for another 9 or 10 years. It was really just an ordinary silk handkerchief. You could see when you got up close, said the woman in the beach chair beside Mrs. Carpenter's. I wish I knew how she tied it. It was really darling. Well, it sounds darling, Mrs. Carpenter agreed. Sybil, hold still. Did you see more glass? Mrs. Carpenter sighed. All right, she said. She replaced the cap on the suntan oil bottle. Now, run and play. Mommy's going up to the hotel and have a martini with Mrs. Hubbell. I'll bring you the olive. Set loose, Sybil immediately ran down to the flat part of the beach and began to walk in the direction of Fisherman's Pavilion. Stopping only to sink a foot in a soggy, collapsed castle, she was soon out of the area reserved for guests of the hotel. She walked for about a quarter of a mile and then suddenly broke into an oblique run up the soft part of the beach. She stopped short when she reached the place where a young man was lying on his back. Are you going in the water?
See, more glass, she said. The young man started, his right hand going to the lapels of his terry cloth robe. He turned over on his stomach, letting a sausage towel fall away from his eyes, and squinted up at Sybil.
Hey! Hello, Sybil!
Are you going in the water?
I was waiting for you, said the young man. What's new?
What?
Said Sybil. What's new? What's on the program?
My daddy's coming tomorrow on a Nary plane,
Sybil said, kicking sand.
Not in my face, baby,
the young man said, putting his hand on Sybil's ankle. Well, it's about time he got here, your daddy. I've been expecting him hourly. Hourly.
Where's the lady?
Sybil said. The lady? The young man brushed some sand out of his thin hair. That's hard to say, Sybil. She may be in any one of a thousand places. At the hairdresser's, having her hair dyed mink, or making dolls for poor children in her room. Lying prone now, he made two fists, set one on top of the other, and rested his chin on the top one. Ask me something else, Sybil, he said. That's a fine bathing suit you have on. If there's one thing I like, it's a blue bathing suit. Sybil stared at him, then looked down at her protruding stomach.
This is yellow, she said. This is a yellow.
It is? Come a little closer. Sybil took a step forward. You're absolutely right. What a fool I am.
Are you going in the water? Sybil said.
Well, I'm seriously considering it. I'm giving it plenty of thought, Sybil. You'll be glad to know. Sybil produced the rubber float that the young man sometimes used as a headrest.
It needs air, she said.
You're right. It needs more air than I'm willing to admit. He took away his fists and let his chin rest on the sand. Sybil, he said, you're looking fine. It's good to see you. Tell me about yourself. And he reached in front of him and took both of Sybil's ankles in his hands. I'm Capricorn, he said. What are you?
Sharon Lipchutz says you let her sit on the piano seat with you, Sybil said.
Sharon Lipchutz said that? Sybil nodded vigorously. He let go of her ankles, drew in his hands, and laid the side of his face on his right forearm. Well, he said, you know how these things happen, Sybil. I was sitting there playing, and you were nowhere in sight. And Sharon Lipchutz came over and sat down next to me. I mean, I couldn't push her off, could I?
Yes.
Oh, no. No, I couldn't do that, said the young man.
I'll tell you what I did do, though.
What? I pretended she was you. Sybil stooped and immediately began to dig in the sand.
Let's go in the water, she said.
All right, said the young man. I think I can work on it.
Next time, push her off,
Sybil said. Push who off?
Sharon Lipchutz.
Ah, Sharon Lipchutz, said the young man. How that name comes up. Mixing memory and desire. He suddenly got to his feet. He looked at the ocean. Sybil, he said, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll see if we can catch a banana fish.
A what?
A banana fish, he said, and undid the belt of his robe. He took off the robe. His shoulders were white and narrow, and his trunks were royal blue. He folded the robe, first lengthwise and then in thirds. He unrolled the towel he had used over his eyes, spread it out on the sand, and then laid the folded robe on top of it. He bent over, picked up the float, and secured it under his right arm. Then, with his left hand, he took Sybil's hand. The two started to walk down to the ocean. I imagine you've seen quite a few banana fish in your day, the young man said. Sybil shook her head. You haven't? Where do you live, anyway?
I don't know, said Sybil.
Sure you know. You must know. Sharon Lipschitz knows where she lives, and she's only 3 1/2. Sybil stopped walking and yanked her hand away from it. She picked up an ordinary beach shell and looked at it with elaborate interest. She threw it down.
Whirlywood, Connecticut, she said,
and resumed walking, stomach foremost. Whirlywood, Connecticut, said the young man. Is that anywhere near Whirlywood, Connecticut, by any chance? Sybil looked at him.
That's where I live, she said impatiently. I live in Whirlywood, Connecticut.
She ran a few steps ahead of him and caught up her left foot in her left hand and hopped two or three times. You have no idea how clear that makes everything, the young man said. Sybil released her foot.
Did you read Little Black Sambo? She said.
It's very funny, if you ask me, he said. It so happens I just finished reading it last night. He reached down and took back Sybil's hand. What did you think of it? He asked her.
Did the tigers run all around the tree?
I thought they'd never stop. I saw so many tigers.
Well, there were only six, Sybil said.
Only six, said the young man. Do you call that only?
Do you like wax? Sybil asked.
Do I like what? Asked the young man.
Wax.
Very much. Don't you? Sybil nodded.
Do you like olives? She asked.
Olives, yes. Olives and wax. I never go any place without them.
Do you like sharing Lipchitz?
Sybil asked. Yes, yes I do, said the young man. What I like particularly about her is that she never does anything mean to little dogs in the lobby of the hotel. That little toy bull that belongs to the lady from Canada, for instance. You probably won't believe this, but some little girls like to poke that little dog with balloon sticks. Sharon doesn't. She's never mean or unkind. That's why I like her so much. Sybil was silent.
I like to chew candles, she said finally.
Well, who doesn't? Said the young man, getting his feet wet. Wow, it's cold. He dropped the rubber float on its back. No, wait just a second, Sybil. Wait till we get out a little bit. They waded out till the water was up to Sybil's waist. And then the young man picked her up and laid her down on her stomach on the float. Don't you ever wear a bathing cap or anything? He asked.
Don't let go, Sybil ordered. You hold me now.
Miss Carpenter, please, I know my business, the young man said. You just keep your eyes open for any banana fish. This is a perfect day for banana fish.
I don't see any, Sybil said.
Well, that's understandable. Their habits are very peculiar. Very peculiar. He kept pushing the float. The water was not quite up to his chest. They lead a very tragic life, he said. You know what they do, Sybil? She shook her head. Well, they swim into a hole where there's a lot of bananas. They're very ordinary-looking fish when they swim in. But once they get in, they behave like pigs. Why, I've known some banana fish to swim into a banana hole and eat as many as 78 bananas. And he edged the float and its passenger a foot closer to the horizon. Naturally, after that, they're so fat they can't get out of the hole again. Can't fit through the door.
Not too far out, Sybil said. What happens to them?
What happens to who?
The banana fish.
Oh, you mean after they eat so many bananas they can't get out of the banana hole?
Yes,
said Sybil. Well, I hate to tell you, Sybil, they die.
Why?
Asked Sybil. Well, they get banana fever. It's a terrible disease.
Here comes a wave,
Sybil said nervously. We'll ignore it. We'll snub it, said the young man. Two snobs. He took Sybil's ankles in his hands and pressed down and forward. The float nosed over the top of the wave. The water soaked Sybil's blonde hair, but her scream was full of pleasure. With her hand, when the float was level again, she wiped away a flat, wet band of hair from her eyes and reported,
I just saw one.
Saw what, my love?
A banana fish.
My God, no, said the young man. Did he have any bananas in his mouth?
Yes, said Sybil. Six.
The young man suddenly picked up one of Sybil's wet feet, which were drooping over the end of the float, and kissed the arch.
Hey,
said the owner of the foot, turning around. Hey yourself. We're going in now. You had enough.
No.
Sorry, he said, and pushed the float toward shore until Sybil got off it. He carried it the rest of the way.
Goodbye,
said Sybil, and ran without regret in the direction of the hotel. The young man put on his robe, closed the lapels tight, and jammed his towel into his pocket. He He picked up the slimy, wet, cumbersome float and put it under his arm. He plodded alone through the soft, hot sand toward the hotel. On the sub-main floor of the hotel, which the management directed bathers to use, a woman with zinc salve on her nose got into the elevator with the young man. "I see you're looking at my feet," he said to her when the car was in motion.
"I beg your pardon," said the woman.
"I said, I see you're looking at my feet."
"I beg your pardon.
I happen to be looking at the floor," said the woman and faced the doors of the car. "If you want to look at my feet, say so," said the young man, "but don't be a goddamn sneak about it."
"Let me out of here, please,"
the woman said quickly to the girl operating the car. The car doors opened, and the woman got off without looking back. "I have two normal feet, and I can't see the slightest goddamn reason why anybody should stare at them," said the young man. "Five, please." He took his room key out of his robe pocket. He got off at the fifth floor, walked down the hall, and let himself into 507. The room smelled of new calfskin luggage and nail lacquer remover. He glanced at the girl lying asleep on one of the twin beds. Then he went over to one of the pieces of luggage, opened it, and from under a pile of shorts and undershirts, he took out an Ortiz caliber 7.65 automatic. He released the magazine, looked at it, then reinserted it. He cocked the piece. Then he went over and sat down on the unoccupied twin bed, looked at the girl, aimed the pistol, and fired a bullet through his right temple. Next, from the February 8, 2010 issue of the New Yorker magazine, the postscript department, J.D. Salinger by Adam Gopnik. J.D. Salinger's long silence and his withdrawal from the world attracted more than the usual degree of gossip and resentment, as though we readers were somehow owed more than his words, were somehow owed his personal talk show presence too, and fed the myth of the author as homespun religious mystic. Yet though he may seem to have chosen a hermit's life, Salinger was no hermit on the page. And so his death throws us back from the myth to the magical world of his writing as it really is, with its matchless comedy, its ear for American speech, its contagious ardor and incomparable charm. Salinger's voice, which illuminated and enlivened these pages for two decades, remade American writing in the 50s and 60s in a way that no one had since Hemingway. The juvenilia of most American writers since bear the mark of one of the other. But if it had been Hemingway's role to make American writing hard-boiled, it was Salinger's to let it be soft, even runny again. For Esme with Love and Squalor, which appeared here in the issue of April 8, 1950, is an account of the horror and battle shock of the Second World War, which the young Salinger fought during some of its worst days and battles, only to end, amazingly, with the offer of an antidote. The simple, direct, and uncorrupted speech that young Esme's letter holds out to the no longer entirely broken narrator. It was the comedy, the overt soulfulness, the high-hearted, to use an adjective he liked, romantic openness of the early Salinger stories that came as such a revelation to readers. The shine of Fitzgerald and the sound of Ring Lardner haunted these pages. But it was Salinger's readiness to be touched, to be touching, his hypersensitivity to the smallest sounds and graces of life, which still startles. Suicides and strange deaths happen in his stories. One shattering story is devoted to the back and forth on the telephone between a betrayed husband and the man in bed with his wife at the very moment. But their tone is alive with an appetite for experience as it is, and the certainty that religious epiphanies will arise from such ordinary experience. A typical Salinger hero
is the little boy who confuses kike with kite and down at the dinghy, who thinks that his father has been maliciously compared to one of those things that go up in the air with string you hold. Salinger was an expansive romantic, an observer of the details of the world, and of New York in particular. No book has ever captured a city better than Catcher in the Rye captured New York in the 40s. Has any writer ever had a better ear for American talk? One thinks of the man occupying the seat behind Holden Caulfield at Radio City Music Hall, who, watching the Rockettes, keeps saying to his wife, "You know what that is? That's precision." A self-enclosed writer doesn't listen, and Salinger was a peerless listener. Page after page of pure talk flowed out of him, moving and true and, above all, funny. He was a humorist with a heart before he was a mystic with a vision, or rather, the vision flowed from the humor. That was the final, almost moral of Zoe, the almost final Salinger story to appear in these pages. Seymour's fat lady, who gives art its audience, is all of us. As for Holden Caulfield, he is so much a part of the lives of his readers that he's more a person to phone up than a character to analyze. A catcher lover in his 40s handed Holden's Christmas journey to his own 12-year-old son a few years ago, filled with trepidation that time and manners would have changed too much for it to still matter. Not a bit. The boy grasped it to his heart as his father had, as the rough guide to his experience, and used its last lines as his yearbook motto. In American writing, there are three perfect books, which seem to speak to every reader and condition: Huckleberry Finn, The Great Gatsby, and The Catcher in the Rye. Of the three, only Catcher defines an entire region of human experience. It is, in French and Dutch, as much as in English, the handbook of the adolescent heart. But the Glass Family saga that followed is the larger accomplishment. Salinger's retreat into that family had its unreality. No family of Jewish intellectual children actually spoke quite like this, or revered one of the members quite so uncritically. But its central concern is universal. The golden thread that runs through it is the question of Seymour's suicide, so shockingly rendered in A Perfect Day for Banana Fish. How, amid so much joyful experience, could life become so intolerable to the one figure who seems to be its master? Critics fretted about the growing self-enclosure of Salinger's work, about a faith in his character's importance that sometimes seemed to make a religion of them. But the isolation of his later decades should not be allowed to obscure his essential gift for joy. The message of his writing was always the same, that amid the malice and falseness of social life, redemption rises from clear speech and childlike enchantment, from all the forms of unself-conscious innocence that still surround us, with the hovering unease that one might mistake emptiness for innocence, as Seymour seems to have done with his Muriel. It resides in the particular things that he delighted to record. In memory, his writing is a catalog of those moments. Esme's letter and her broken watch, and the little girl with the dachshund that leaps up on Park Avenue in Zoe, and the record of little Shirley Beans that Holden buys for Phoebe and then sees break on the pavement, and Phoebe's coat spinning on the carousel at twilight in the December light of Central Park, and the Easter chick left in the wastebasket at the end of Just Before the War with the Eskimos, and Buddy at the magic twilight hour in New York, after learning from Seymour how to play Zen marbles. Could you try not aiming so much? Running to get Lewis Sherry ice cream, only to be overtaken by his brother and the small girl on the plane who turns her doll's head around to look at Seymour. That these things were not in themselves quite enough to hold Seymour on this planet, or enough, it seems, at times, to hold his creator entirely here either, does not diminish the beauty of their realization. In Seymour, an introduction. Seymour, thinking of Van Gogh, tells Buddy that the only question worth asking about a writer is, were most of your stars out? Writing, real writing, is done not from some seat of fussy moral judgment, but with the eye and the ear and the heart. No American writer will ever have a more alert ear, a more attentive eye, or a more ardent heart than his. Next, from the page-turner department of the January 29, 2010 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Remembering Salinger by A.M. Holmes. I feel as though my father has died. There are biological parents and adoptive parents, and then there are appropriated parents, artistic or intellectual parents, as instrumental in your development as any other parent or more so, because they are selected by you. It is in that vein that I tell you, J.D. Salinger was my father. Apologies to his biological offspring and my own multiple parents. Like any parental relationship, one can't exactly remember becoming aware of the parent as a someone other than a parent, i.e. the notion of Salinger as not just my father, but a writer. Not just a writer, but a hero. Not just a hero, but an icon. Not just an icon, but a complicated case. Talk about the anxiety of influence. This is literally about how one writer makes another. And like any coming to consciousness, it happened in bits and pieces, fragments. I don't know when I first read A Perfect Day for Banana Fish, but I remember when it started to make sense. It began in the 1970s with a conflation of Dustin Hoffman as Benjamin in The Graduate and Seymour Glass, two lost young men poolside. Added to the mix is Hoffman again as Carl Bernstein in All the President's Men, the real world events of my hometown, Washington, D.C., Vietnam, and Watergate were the backdrop to my emerging consciousness. Scenes from the movie were filmed near my junior high school, and I played hooky to stand around and snap Polaroids of the actors, like a wannabe Warhol. The process of transforming fact into fiction, reporters into movie stars, is part of the warp that became my experience. It's the 1970s. I'm sweating in some polyester shirt with a wide collar and my elephant leg bell bottoms. So cool. I know beaches and hotels from family vacations spent at the Delaware shore riding the waves on a rubber raft and getting so sunburned I have to stay in bed for days, covered in salve. Here I think of Salinger's sunburned Muriel, finally able to get a call through to her mother, who has been worried sick and repeatedly asks, "Are you all right, Muriel? Tell me the truth." The conversation between Muriel and her mother reminds me of the phrasing, the intonation of the Jewish mother's accent on The Call from Long Island, a comedy routine performed by Arlene Galunka and Betty Walker on my favorite childhood record, You Don't Have to Be Jewish. On December 8, 1980, I am 19 years old, suffering separation anxiety so profound I can't manage to actually go away to college, living in my parents' home, taking classes at American University in Washington, D.C. December 8th is my best friend's birthday. She is a year and 10 days older than me, and I am on the phone with her when I hear the news that John Lennon has been shot. It is late at night, and quickly the news comes that Lennon is dead. I am nauseated, feeling like something horribly wrong has happened. Something has pulled the basic theory of relativity out of whack. And shortly thereafter, I hear that Mark David Chapman pulled a copy of The Catcher in the Rye out of his pocket and stood there reading it as Lennon lay dying. It is unbearable. The psychotic misappropriation of literature, sacred stuff that belonged not just to one of us, but to all of us. I am compelled to write. The Smith Corona that my mother typed my poems on has now become my preferred instrument. I'm taking a course in playwriting, and I write a play titled The Call-In Hour, the story of how Holden Caulfield was a real person who long ago met J.D. Salinger on a subway train and goes on a radio call-in show to ask people to quit clinging to the book to get on with their lives. People call in with questions, confessions, wanting to know if Holden turned out okay. The final caller is J.D. Salinger himself. I naively send the play to theaters across the country, only to have it win the playwriting contest at the Source Theater in Washington, D.C. I was summoned to the theaters to meet the producers, and I remember sitting there watching them walk back and forth, checking watches, not realizing that I was the person they were waiting for. They were shocked. I may have been 19, but I looked 12. They had no idea that A.M. Holmes wasn't some guy in his 40s. The play opened in Washington in 1982. I was 20 years old, still living at home. How is it possible that 28 years have passed since then? How is it possible that at 91 Salinger is dead? How is it possible that at 91 Salinger is dead? Will there be something more from him? Some gift from the grave? Will we ever see the years or writing kept private? Or is what we have already enough? Without Salinger hiding out in Cornish, New Hampshire, his silence a kind of Buddhist echo, answering by not answering, sending the big questions back to us. I'm not sure that I want more. I'm content with what I have, and I am in awe of the strange and not so subtle way we have carried this quiet, sagacious lion with us like some beloved, worn, stuffed animal, and have woven his words, his way of thinking, inexorably into our DNA. We are all his characters. We are all Holden Caulfield, Seymour Glass, and the whole Glass family. We're out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcast at ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today.